Hey, everybody, Stu Smith here with another Tactical Fitness Report. We have special guest Ward Carroll, Class of 82, U.S. Naval Academy, F-14 Rio, that's Radio Intercept Officer.
Radar Intercept Officer?
Yeah.
Yes, you were very close.
So close. I'm not very familiar with that cool pilot stuff, Ward. However, I will say you were there at the academy when probably Top Gun came out. Was that right? Because I remember came out when I was in high school, like 86, 87.
No, maybe. I was actually in my first fighter squadron when Top Gun came out.
Oh, okay.
I was in VF-32, the Swordsman. We had switched from the USS Independence, where I did my first deployment, to the USS John F. Kennedy. We changed air wings. We were in the middle of workups, getting ready to go on deployment. And so it came out in May of 1986.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got my ears screwed up. Yeah, yeah, sorry about that.
I was a full-up lieutenant in my first fighter squadron, and I'd actually worked with Top Gun the summer before the movie came out, the real Top Gun, and the dudes who did all the flying were the guys that we trained with in what was called FARP, which is Fleet Fighter Air Readiness Program. So Top Gun would do a roadshow where they came out to the fleet and helped with our dogfighting training. So I'd met, you know, Hollywood Dishart and Bio Baranek and Jaws Winnefeld, who went on to be the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who I remain good friends with. And all these folks who, if you look at the credits at the end of Top Gun, these are the names you see scrolling by. So it was quite a time to be flying the F-14, you know,
because
it was in the public consciousness in a big way. The O Club on Wednesday and Friday was crazy. So these were good days, you know, it was a good time.
Yeah, I remember the O Clubs were still pretty crazy. And where was it? Oceana Sundays on Fort Story.
Well, Fort Story on Sundays.
Oh, man. Right? That was still crazy in the 90s.
That was the, you know, Oceana Wednesday, Friday. And then, you know, you'd finish your weekend at Fort Story.
Whew.
But those days are long gone.
Different times. Late 80s, early 90s. That is
absolutely
for sure.
Different time.
Well, let's just talk about some of the stresses that occur on pilots. Because we have a lot of folks that listen to this that want to be serving in some manner. And, you know, some of them are ground beaters and, you know, spec ops guys, but we also have a lot of pilots too. And that's one of the great things about going to the Naval Academy. When I was mid 80s, when Top Gun came out, that was really my first introduction to what the Naval Academy was. I mean, I grew up in a little town in North Florida. You know, I didn't know what the Naval Academy was. I heard about the Army Navy game, it kind of stuck there somewhere. And then slowly started learning a little bit more about it. And then, of course, Top Gun came out and I started doing all kinds of research, and that changed everything for me. My original plan was to play football and be a pilot at the Naval Academy. I did neither. So
you played rugby and became a SEAL.
Yeah. So it was
kind of close. It's
you
not
know,
that far.
It's, right? You know, we play and God laughs. So,
okay. Yep. Exactly right.
So, with that, you know, was there particular types of training that you really had to really focus on before you went into flight school?
Well, so the training that we get as a function of being a midshipman at the Naval Academy sort of sets you up for success, right? We're in great physical shape by the time you show up at Pensacola. We have a lot of swim background as a function of going to the Naval Academy. You know, there are certain things you do in PE. We have, I forget how many semesters of swimming you wind up doing, but
oh, yeah.
You know, there's the one mile swim, and they're really into technique. So you learn how to do the side stroke, and you learn how to do the elementary backstroke, and you learn how to breathe properly and, you know, conserve your energy. We learn all that as midshipmen. And so when you show up to flight school, the first 6 weeks is called aviation indoc. I think it's called API now, but either AI or API. And It includes some basic classroom work, engineering and navigation, and sort of the basics of the world you're now into. And then there's a survival school that it's about 3 days long, where you go out to near Eglin Air Force Base and hang out in the wilds of what we call Southern Alabama for a few days, you know, the panhandle of Florida.
Was that your SEER school?
No, SEER school is different. Okay. This is different, right? This is survival in during AI.
Oh, okay.
And then there used to be some boxing. Again, as Academy grads, we had a huge advantage.
Boxing class.
Over our ROTC or OCS counterparts, right? Because we had had a lot of boxing. And so it was fun to kind of beat the hell out of ROTC guys. We didn't know the basics of ducking and covering and jab, jab, power hand. They didn't know any of these things, right? They just come in wildly swinging. And so the Academy, they hated going against Academy guys because they knew we knew how to box.
That's funny.
And then swimming. There was a lot of swimming, and it involved flight gear and climbing in and out of rafts, both individual rafts and group rafts, and you know, doing the helo dunker, which is you simulating the crash of a helicopter, and you know, the helicopter rolls over. And then they don't do this anymore, but it is actually in An Officer and a Gentleman. You remember the movie The Officer and a Gentleman, where it was the single airplane crash, and that's the one where the character kind of freaks out, and they have to help him get out of it. And so we did that. It was called the Dilbert Dunker.
Oh yeah.
Back in the day.
I think we were in the back seat doing that too.
Okay.
We did that training as well.
Yeah. So they still do the Hilo Dunker, which is like a big, you know, can that has eight seats in it, and it hits and then rolls over, and you wait till the motion stops and get out. And so we do that. And then you do the dunker, but it's the swim training piece that petitions your physical, you know, performance. And so what I particularly was challenged by in that phase was not just the tread water piece. So treading water, as you say, is like vertical swimming. Technique matters. You want to make sure you're not wasting any energy with how you paddle your feet and how you move your hands to stay, you know, just above the surface, you know? So you do that for 10 minutes and in full flight gear without your life preserver that you're wearing blown up.
It's tough. Swimming with clothes on is horrible.
Right. But now add to the clothes, a G suit, a harness, and an LPU and a helmet, right? So you're treading water and you're starting to get winded. And then the instructors around the edge of the pool will say, drown proof. So now the challenge is, and your heart is jumping out of your chest. I don't care what shape you're in. And I was in great shape, right? And now the challenge is stop moving. Let your lungs fill up with air. And then occasionally take a breath and then float, right? So what you want to do is get your heart rate down and, you know, conserve your energy until a helicopter can pick you up or a ship or whatever, right? The idea is your life preserver was shredded to bits as you ejected out of the airplane. So you drown proof for a while, or you tread water and then you drown proof. So what was tough for me at first was stopping the movement. Because again, your heart's jumping out of your chest and you need breath, you need oxygen. And so I kept like, and they're yelling, stop moving, you know? And I'm like, I can't. If I stop moving, I'm going to drown, right? And so first time, finally, and you can't tread water. Again, I don't care how good a shape you're in. You can't frantically tread water for more than 10 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's really tough. Absolutely.
It's tough. So they have a long stick and they put that stick in your face and you grab it. And as soon as you grab it, you're a flunk. Right. So they drag you to the side of the pool and you're sitting there and you feel like an idiot. And you can do it. You go to what's called stupid swim, where you practice your technique. And so I was having trouble getting it. Right. And so I was almost about to get pulled back to the AI class behind my class, which meant I wasn't going to be in the VT10 class that I wanted to be in, which follows AI. And I'm like, look, So I actually, because they have issued you your flight gear. I live in an apartment complex, Northeast Pensacola, called, what was it called? Executive House. It's called something else now. It's on Bayou Boulevard there.
Yeah.
And they had a pool, right? So on the weekend, I broke out the flight gear, all of it, and jumped into the pool and treaded water and practiced trying to transition to drown proofing. And so you can imagine my bikini clad neighbors are looking at me like I'm insane.
Sure.
Plus I'm taking up the entire deep end. Like, don't come around me while I'm doing this. Right. So it was like a spectator sport watching Ward do his, you know, flight training. And so, but the aha moment came, which is when you stop moving. And again, your heart is just, it's beating in your ears, and you know how it feels when you're really winded. And finally you feel the rate come down. You just, you hit that tipping point. You're like, oh, I'm not going to die. And now you do the breath and now you're good. So when I had that aha moment, went back the next week, passed, good to go. Right. So that was a lesson that was about technique more than, you know, fitness necessarily.
Oh, absolutely.
So that was my first challenge in flight school, because doing the obstacle course or the other stuff was not hard. Although doing an obstacle course in sand will wind you. And we look at the obstacle course. Remember the one we used to have at the Academy on Hospital Point?
Yeah.
Right. And you get pretty winded by the end of that too. But this one was in sand, and that's a whole different animal, right? So that would challenge you as well, but that was no big deal. And any of the other runs that we did or whatever, fine. But this was a particular thing that tripped me up. That was the first thing that tripped me up. So then done with AI, pilots go to Whiting, north of Pensacola, to start flying the T-34. At this time now, they fly the T-6 Texan, Texan 2, actually. And then NFOs, naval flight officers, which is backseaters and other parts of the airplane besides controlling it, go to VT-10 at Mainside Pensacola. Now at VT-10, you had 3 months of ground school before you ever saw an airplane. Mm. So this is, you know, weather, how to file a flight plan, how to do navigation. You had these simulators where you would do point-to-point navigation. You were actually put a pencil on a TACAN to go from, you know, this range to this range and give a heading and wind factored in. It was started thinking in terms of what is my responsibility going to be as a navigator, naval flight officer.
Okay. Yeah.
This is before I knew what kind of airplane I was going to be assigned to. And I didn't even know really what I wanted necessarily. I had a sense I wanted to go into Tomcats because, you know, I'd seen Final Countdown when I was at the Academy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Remember that movie? Yep. I actually have an episode where I dissect that movie, by the way. But I saw that there was a movie theater, I don't know if it was still there when you were a mid, on Main Street in Annapolis that's not there anymore. Hmm. And so that's where I saw, that's actually where I saw Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, and Final Countdown.
Oh, classics.
In that, yeah. And then there was another movie theater, since we're talking about things that aren't in Annapolis anymore, on State Circle, right?
Oh, yeah, those
State
were there.
Theater. Yeah. Yeah, it's a restaurant now. But that's where I saw Animal House as a plebe. Four times plebe first semester plebe year. So in any case, when I saw Final Countdown, I was like, that looks like a cool airplane. And then when I was a mid, I got a backseat ride in a Marine Corps F-4 in Hawaii. And that's what finally gave me the, okay, I want to go NFO, because I knew my eyes were bad. So I wasn't going to be able to be a pilot, but I wanted to get into aviation. So my way in was to select naval flight officer. And oh, by the way, my dad was a Marine Corps pilot, an attack pilot who flew A-4s and A-6s. So that was my major influence for wanting to go aviation. But
I'm sorry to interrupt. I had interviewed a 78 grad recently, who was a Marine Corps F-4 pilot, last name Mabry, James Mabry. I don't know if you crossed paths over the years. Great guy. Yeah. He only did like his time like 8 years in, and then he became a 30-year firefighter. So we've been talking tactical fitness on that level. So with you being in, you know, going through your training in the 80s, and now it's coming into the 90s. You did 20 years as a pilot, correct? Rio. I always screw that up. So thank you, Navy.
I don't want the people to get all.
I know.
Hey, he's not a pilot.
So
get ahead of that.
Any interesting stories going into other aircraft, maybe that you were also flying in your journey, and some of the missions that you were doing with those?
No, absolutely. So, to start at the beginning of, you know, pulling G's, which is the thing that's challenging in terms of physical, right? And this isn't how the training syllabus is anymore, but back when I was going through NFO training, the first airplane you got into was a T2 Buckeye, a jet capable of 6.5 G's and all kinds of aerobatic flight. You're strapping into an ejection seat and wearing an oxygen mask from your first flight on. So that was a huge leap of faith. And a lot of people decided I love jets at that point, or there's no way I want to fly a jet. This is how P3 naval flight officers were made.
Okay.
Right? Because they'd get airsick and they'd absolutely hate the feeling of G and being inverted and all this sort of thing. So I loved it. I hadn't had, as I said, one flight in an F4 out in Hawaii. And so I knew I was going to love it as a function of that flight. You have to sort of get used to the idea of what G feels like and how do you keep your head, right? So I have a handy little diagram here, right? So basically there are two axes that affect naval aviators, right? One is the Z axis, which is on a catapult shot when you're zorching off the front of an aircraft carrier, where you go from 0 to 150 miles an hour in 2.2 seconds. Some roller coasters these days can replicate that G-force. I've been on some. There's one at Six Flags over here on Route 214 that, you know, starts like that. But you can imagine in an F-14 that was upwards of 72,000 pounds at takeoff, a cat shot on a conventional carrier was quite a kick in the pants. Oh, right. Man. So that's this axis. And then going from 140 knots, which is about 150 miles an hour, to stopping with your tail hook is another feeling that is this axis. But the physical challenge is in the Z axis, which is G. So as you and I are sitting here now, we're at 1G, right?
Yes.
If you're flying around, we got our training aid here. This is a Legacy Hornet. F-18C, right? So as we're flying around straight and level, we're at 1G here too. So, you know, gravity as it's affecting us now is also affecting us in the cockpit. Now, as soon as we start to maneuver the airplane, we're multiplying the force of gravity. And you can also negate the force of gravity by pushing forward on the stick and doing either zero or negative G. But let's just talk about positive G. So modern airplanes can do upwards of 9 G's.
Woo.
So I weigh, let's say, 200 pounds, more or less. So if I'm pulling 9 G's, I weigh 1,800 pounds. So the physical effect on me is gravity starts to pull the blood out of my head and the oxygen that's in that blood. So I get what's called hypoxic. So I combat that through some gear. We wear G suits, which wrap around your legs and your torso, plug into the airplane. As G is put on the airplane, air is vented into these bladders to try to keep the blood from pooling. But you also have to have great core strength to combat the blood rushing out of your head. And why is this? Because at some point, first you'll gray out, then you'll black out, and then you'll have what's called G-induced loss of consciousness, which the acronym is GLOC. Okay, so the problem with that is if you're controlling the airplane and you have GLOC, you're no longer controlling the airplane. So there are two main issues with that. at high altitude, if you're dogfighting, now let's say I got a guy rolling in on me, I'm defending, right? So I've got 9 Gs and I'm not doing proper anti-G techniques, which we'll discuss in a second. And I basically knock myself out. So as I go night-night, I stop pulling Gs. So I've just solved my enemy's problem. If I'm generating this turn and now I'm, so now all he has to do is roll in on me and shoot me. If I'm at low altitude, say I'm doing a terrain, you know, map of the earth kind of thing, terrain following, trying to ingress into some target without being seen by radar. And I have G lock at low altitude. Now I'm going to hit the ground. Now I'll remind your viewers that the Blue Angels actually lost an airplane in 2007, where in this footage, I feature this footage on my most recent episode about G tolerance, pulling Gs on my channel. But a guy named Lieutenant Commander Kojak Davis was trying to salvage a rendezvous and he blacked himself out at low altitude and you can just see the airplane hit the trees. So this is something that obviously is not good and we have to train against. So how do we do this? Well, core strength is fundamental to tactical aviators. That's part A, to include, well, you know, core, abdomen, back, but also abductors, thighs, calves. You've got to be top-notch fitness in order to combat G in the modern environment where a Super Hornet, F-35, F-16 can pull, F-15 EX can pull 9.5, 10 Gs. So now the limiting factor is no longer the airplane because Tomcat, my airplane could only pull, I mean, it could pull more, but it was limited to 6.5 Gs, right? So that's doable. But now you start getting to 9 Gs and it's harder. So to your original question, I apologize for taking that security.
No, that was great. I was going to ask you, what's a G?
Yeah. So a G is just a measure of the force of gravity.
Right.
Right. Newton on the head, you know, 9.8 meters per second squared is the acceleration due to gravity. 9.8 newtons is the force of gravity. So 6.5 Gs, did it for years. I remember one of my first F-14 training flights in what was called the RAG, which is the replacement air group. So you go through flight training, get your wings, show up to whatever type airplane you're going to fly. So by this time I'd selected radar intercept officer, was my pipeline, get my wings. And now I was assigned to VF-101, the Grim Reapers, which is the F-14 training squadron at Naval Air Station Oceana in Virginia Beach, Virginia. The other choice at that point was Naval Air Station Miramar, which is featured in the movie Top Gun, which is now a Marine Corps air station, by the way. Top Gun moved from Miramar to Fallon, separate discussion. But in any case, I was more of an East Coast kind of guy. And so I got my wishes, which was go to Virginia Beach, right? So flying my first dogfighting hop in the F-14. And the F-14 was a great dogfighting airplane in spite of its size. It's a gigantic airplane for
Huge.
Yeah. Huge. So basically 65 feet wide with the wings at 20 degrees, which is fully forward, and about 65 feet long. So we called her the big fighter. Capable of good dogfighting, good pitch authority, could do 6.5 Gs, no problem, right? So I'm looking over my shoulder. And again, as a Rio, I don't have any controls in the control of the airplane. My controls control sensors and the radar and different things in the backseat. So I'm looking over my shoulder, trying to make sure that a bad guy isn't about to roll in on us as my pilot is trying to prosecute the bad guy in front of us, doing a 2v2 dogfighting hop flight. And so I'm looking and the pilot pulls G and I wasn't prepared. So my vision just goes away. I black out. I'm not G-locked, but I don't have enough blood in my eyes to generate sight.
Damn.
You know, and so my pilot's like, where's the bandit? And I said, I don't know, I'm blacked out. And he was like, wrong answer. You know, so you've got to do the proper anti-G techniques to combat that blood flowing out of your head, because otherwise we're going to get killed, and that's not an option, right? So the proper G techniques have evolved over the years. When I first started pulling Gs, it was basically just grunt, you know, and just cinch down and hold it. And then from there, after a few too many G episodes where airplanes were either lost or, you know, pilots admitted, yeah, I blacked myself out, or I gave myself G-lock. And as a RIO, sometimes you would know when your pilot was no longer flying the airplane. Right? That was a scary thought. If you're flying around at 350 knots, the airplane suddenly kind of goes limp, nose down, and you start accelerating through safe ejection airspeeds in short order, and your pilot's kind of slumped over. You know, we have HUD tapes that are basically RIOs begging pilots to come to, because now they have no option. They can choose which way they want to die. Either they're going to eject and be shredded to bits or hit the ground, right? Not a good matrix. So this is an issue that needed to be combated. So they came up, the aviation physiologists came up with this thing called the hook maneuver. So the hook maneuver was a way to sort of deliberately keep the blood from pooling in your extremities. And so what you would do is at the onset of G, you'd go hook, hook, which is kind of forces you kind of do in the back of your throat, and right? And so that was it. Do the hook maneuver. However, it turns out that the hook maneuver after about 5 seconds is inefficient. And so now you're working too hard and you're going to actually black yourself out. So it's now evolved into a combination of isometrics and controlled breathing, timed breathing. Mm. So I entreat the audience to, again, look at my most recent episode about pulling Gs, the real truth about pulling Gs, because I go into what the most recent technique is. And I show you some centrifuge training. So the other thing that aviators have to do now, or jet aviators, not every aviator, but you know, folks who are going to be flying tactical jets, they go to a centrifuge, which is basically a little capsule on an arm in a room that spins around. And in that, when they turn that capsule, they can generate as many Gs as they want. Mm. So there's a guy watching you on the TV, and it's, you know, you're framed like this, and they're coaching you on your anti-G straining maneuver, AGSM. And there's a lot of humorous videos of people going night-night. And then what happens when you come to is, there's a scientific term for it, but we call it the funky chicken, right? So when you come to and your brain starts to get oxygenated again, your body reacts by, you kind of go limbs all over the place. And sometimes people make weird noises. And again, my video features some of these things. So the point is, you don't want to have G-lock. And the way to not have G-lock is to, you know, make sure your flight, your G-suit fits, that you don't black yourself out if you're the pilot, or if you're not the pilot, like a weapon system officer or somebody in another part of the airplane, the pilot needs to coordinate with you about, okay, pull coming, you know, and I always had this good coordination with my Tomcat drivers. I had an opportunity to fly with the Blue Angels when you and I were working together when I was the editor of military.com in 2012. And through a series of cool happenstances, I was able to secure a flight with the Blue Angels in the actual show itself. And so I was in Blue Angel number 4, the flight started out, and the other, oh, by the way, so it had been 14 years since I'd flown a tactical jet. My last Tomcat flight was in April of 98. Here it is, September of 2012. Now, I'm still in pretty good shape, I believe, but as you might imagine here, is technique and practice. Right? Iteration.
Oh, sure.
In the environment, right? So the other thing about the Blue Angels is they don't wear G-suits. Mm. And they don't wear G-suits, which a G-suit will give you about 2.5 or 3 more Gs of tolerance, but they don't wear them because they don't want the leg to blow up and move their arm because they're flying so close, right? And they don't want that thing happening. So they train for the anti-G stuff quite a bit, and especially in the wake of that mishap in 2007, where Blue Angel number 6 had G-lock. So they're working out twice a day. They're very much into core strength. They do the centrifuge annually. So meanwhile, here's Ward climbing in the back, Blue Angel number 4, a Marine Corps Major Brent Stevens, call sign Face. So I was in two-seater, obviously, and we go flying. So first part of routine is a lot of the diamond stuff. So not a whole lot of G. We're in the slot, you know, number 4 position.
So cool. So cool.
It was very cool. And they are super close. So again, I entreat everybody to look at my episode about the Blue Angels. And I have my footage of just how close they are and how hard they're working. I know it from the ground, it looks very sort of harmonious and smooth, but in the air, they're actually working their asses off, you know, and there's a lot of movement. But towards the end of the routine, they start doing the breakups and the crossing maneuvers. And so those come with a lot of G. Right. So Face in the brief gave me, you know, hey, we're going to have to work hard. And I was like, oh, yeah, hook maneuver. He goes, no, we don't do hook anymore. And he demonstrated this breathing intervals with isometrics. And I was like, oh, OK, I kind of got it. Right. But unless you've done it, you're probably not going to do it right. The other thing is the Super or the Hornet that we were flying was a 7.5 G airplane, no G suit. So I'm gutting it out. Staying awake, as we say, for 3/4 of the performance. And then we get to this one part where we crossed. We were the low guy of the 6. They all cross at different altitudes. It gives you the illusion of, you know, about to hit each other. And so we're going, you know, parallel in the runway. And he goes, here we go. And he wraps the airplane up, you know, wraps the airplane up and then boom. Rapid onset to 7.5 G's.
Oh,
now when you fly with the Blue Angels, they have a video camera facing you. So for the viewers of my channel, this is captured for posterity. And I make this part of my Pulling G's episode, which is you can see me get behind the airplane almost immediately. I mean, I'm trying to do some proper anti-G straining maneuvers, but I'm already behind the power curve and there's no way to get back once you get that far behind. Especially if you don't have your hands on the controls. The other thing is, as a trainer, you relate to this. If you have people doing burpees or crunches and you're like, just start and I'll tell you when to finish, right? So as the person doing them, you're like, should I conserve my energy or should I go all out? You know, so I had no idea how many degrees of turn we were going to do here. Is this a couple seconds? Is this 10 seconds? Right? So this is all conspiring against me to sort of make me get G-lock. So you can see in very short order, I just plant my head back in my mouth, right? So now I'm out. Now, fortunately, he's at the control, so he's not out. And he notices that I'm not awake, right? And I come to, I do a mini funky chicken, like my head kind of goes, right? And he says my name, which is a good way to get somebody back to the present. He says, Ward, you all right? I'm like, immediately, like, what's that? He's like, how you doing? I'm like, I'm great. He's like, okay. And then we went right into another high G maneuver. And now I'm fighting hard and I'm like, God damn it, I'm not going to get G lock again. Right. So it was a lesson in not just the physicality piece, but the technique part. So in fitness, it's not all just, you know, smash your head against the wall. As you teach and as viewers of this channel know, technique is fundamental, as well as just having the strength to do any given routine or maneuver or whatever. So this is what, if people are thinking, I want to go into jets, I love it. I think that's the best option. Obviously that's the path I pursued and the one that has still become sort of my root node in terms of what my YouTube channel is about, the theme of my YouTube channel. However, to be successful in tactical aviation, you have to have physical prowess and you have to be in good shape. And this isn't just at the outset. This is if you're a captain or a one star who's still flying, you have to have great physical strength, because airplanes they're flying today, like the F-16 or F-35, Super Hornet, the Growler, these airplanes are capable of upwards of 9 Gs.
Damn. Right?
So the limiting factor is no longer the machine, it's the meat puppet in the machine, you know? And so we got to make sure that we can fight to win and not knock ourselves out in the process. So,
what were some of the core activities you guys would do? And as well as like the Blue Angels are doing, are they doing a lot of deadlifts and kettlebell work? And are they doing a lot of, you know, ab work and lower back work? Is any specifics that very helpful?
Abs, deadlifts, not so much, but, you know, abs, crunches, kettlebells, side to side.
Your obliques.
You know, for your obliques. Back, as I said, hamstrings, calves. So you're doing leg work. But mostly you want your abs to be, because it's a crunch of your abs is your primary defense against the blood pooling, along with what I said, which is the breathing technique. And again, I entreat the viewer to watch that episode. You can see people doing it right, and they can go for upwards of 10 seconds, and people doing it wrong, like I did, which is in that one case, you know, again, my alibis are, first time I fell in a long time and I didn't know how much G was coming on or how long it would last. Plus, I wasn't wearing a G suit for the first time ever in a tactical jet. So, but you can see other examples of folks not doing either thing right, the straining or the breathing. So the Blues, like I said, they right now, in fact, as we're recording this, they're out in El Centro getting ready for the next season, El Centro, California, Imperial Valley, where they have their winter training. So the three new guys on the team and the other veterans are putting the band together and getting ready for the show season that's going to start in March. And I've been out there on a bombing debt with the F-14 training squadron when I was an instructor, when the Blues were there, and have shared the gym with them. They got their own side. It's sort of like an NFL team where you can't use their Gucci gear. You know, we're over here with the other stuff, and they got the cool stuff happening. But they're very much, as I said, they're doing two-a-days with the flying and a building block approach to the full-up routine, and two-a-days with the workouts. Obviously, nutrition is very important to them as well. So their diet is what you would put out as a best practice diet. You know, no fats, no processed foods, because this helps your blood processed oxygen more efficiently. And that's what's going to keep you from getting G-lock. So what I had seen when I'm watching, like to your question, is like, and again, we're talking circa early 90s. So they've modified to the best practices that you know about.
It's evolved, you know, significantly.
It's evolved, for sure. Right. Yeah. And so then it was a lot of, you know, elevated bench crunches and some grinders on the blow up balls and a lot of sort of machine work, but primarily focused on your abs and a lot of leg lifts and, you know, using the machine to push your legs for your leg muscles. Again, focus on front of your thighs and your calves, because those are the ones that you can just feel it. If you're sitting here and you're like, okay, stomach and calves, right? That's what you're going to cinch down, right? Okay. And then the good breathing, like, and you hold it because you don't want to breathe in between the hold, but you want the hold to be efficient in terms of the preservation of oxygen in your brain, right? And so if I'm just like, then that's not efficient. The oxygen isn't staying in place for any meaningful amount of time. Plus I'm working too hard, you know? So this is what you learn. But again, the Blues, again, not wearing G suits, which some officials in the Navy are not cool with, right? They're like, now remind me why you guys don't wear G suits. You know, and like, because our arm is going to move. Like, yeah, I kind of want to throw a BS flag on that. Like, No, that's it. And oh, by the way, we do all these special exercises and we're very focused on G tolerance. So thank you for your interest in the Blue Angels. We're fine. You know, and they
do look good in their flight suits though.
They're tight flight suits.
Yeah. They are definitely fit.
Yeah, they are fit, right? You gotta be.
Yeah.
Right. Cause they're the face of naval aviation and, you know, the US Navy. So they do the job right. Very impressed with, because I was one of those who would make fun of them as well as a fleet operator, you know, tight blue flight suits and whatnot. And, you know, you meet, you know, some guys who are in the, on the team along the way, you know, former squadron mates. And, you know, he's one of the gang when you were in the squadron, the fighter squadron together, and then he goes to be a Blue Angel and you see him, you know, at a show and he's like, kind of like too cool for school. You're like, what? Right. And I didn't quite get it until I flew with him and did the brief and the debrief. And I'm like, okay, there's a standard here that's over and above what a fleet fighter squadron standard is, right? In terms of zero defect. Not that okay with doing things wrong in a fighter squadron, but when you're flying 300 shows a year, 45 minutes and inches away from each other, you know, time and time again in front of a crowd, that's a level of rigor that is unique. And so I get it now, and I get why just any pilot can't be a Blue Angel. But you've got to be okay with repetition in a way that really, I think NSW replicates this, you know, sort of this pursuit of perfection. Not everybody's up for it.
Master the basics and
master. Yeah. But beyond just, I get it. No, it's like, no, mastery.
Yes.
You know, competence and mastery are the difference between shooting in the 80s and shooting in the 70s as a golfer, right? That's no minor. Or being a chord banger or somebody who can improvise around a blues progression on guitar. Now I got my guitars here, but you know, these kinds of challenges. So if anybody watching this is aspiring to go to the Naval Academy or ROTC or whatever, and then thinks beyond that, they'd like to do either SEALs or Naval Aviation, which are probably the two best choices, obviously.
And I would agree.
Just understand that what you're signing up for is a level of effort that's above whatever is the minimum acceptable, right? And so this is who, and then even in flight school, just like when you get through BUDS, it's like, okay, do you want to be a DevGru guy or are you going to be just a fleet operator or what? The competition or the achievement isn't over.
Oh, right? It keeps moving forward. Yeah,
and that's the good news, right? That's like this lifelong learning, lifelong dedication to fitness and self-improvement, something you and I both possess. That's part of the program, you know? And so class standing matters in terms of how can you get the selection you want.
True.
I will say if I tried as hard at the Naval Academy as I did in flight school, I would have been a 4.0 grade point average kind of guy. I was not. I was a 2.7 grade point average kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I mean, things worked out. But, you know, this application towards a desired outcome is what the promise of a service academy is. And it's also what the promise of these warfare specialties are. And that's why I tell people this is a really great consequential way to live your life and to dedicate yourself. And so naval aviation, tactical aviation, carrier-based tactical aviation was something I'm very proud to have done. I feel lucky to have been allowed to do it to the degree I was, because all I did during my 20 years was fly jets, except for the last point where I taught at the Naval Academy, which was another gift.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, I'd love going back there. It was...
great. You know, so the Navy was very good to me. And I dare say it's because I was good at flying the F-14 or being in the backseat of the F-14. And the Navy recognized that. And so, you know, if you dedicate yourself and you wind up being good at it, then the Navy's going to kind of get out of the way of that reality and allow you to thrive, you know? And so that's the other thing, just, you know, my call sign's Mooch, but you know, Mooch sort of tidbits is, you know, the military is not a monolithic blob. Sometimes I'll be, you know, in a civilian thing and they treat me like I'm Gomer Pyle or something, right? Like everybody's kind of, oh yeah, you lived in a Quonset hut and you carried a rifle and that was it, right? Like, and it's like, no, And so the military, in this case, we're talking about the Navy, will recognize who you are as an individual if you allow them to. And this means you apply yourself and then accommodate that path. This is my experience. This is why I think aspiring as a high schooler, aspiring to go to the Naval Academy particularly, is such a good way to go. And what I will also say about the Naval Academy now, because like you, I work on the Naval Academy grounds part-time, and I'm very much in touch with MIDS. I was just at the basketball game last night. Navy lost, unfortunately. We're playing Army on Saturday, so it's fun to be a member of the community here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And plug in. But what I'm saying, and I say this to my classmates who are like old guys and, you know, those angry old men that we know about now, like, it's not as good as it used to be. That's not true.
No,
I'm better than ever in terms of resources, in terms of opportunities. And I think NSW is a great example of that. You know, when I was a MID, you couldn't go right into SEALs. You had to be a service warfare guy, get your SWO pin, and then maybe you could apply to have a transition into, you know, SEALs and go to BUTS. Now, because of the program you run and the other sort of very deliberate things that are done for SEALs that think they want to do it, also there's so much rigor around, okay, you think you want to be a SEAL, let's try. So by the time it comes time for selection, you guys have sort of filtered it to the degree that the chance for success at BUDS is very high.
Yes.
That wasn't always the case. I have a classmate who's actually now a brain surgeon who went to BUDS and didn't make it, you know, and this guy was a runner at the academy and he's in great physical shape, but because there wasn't a program like you,
the prep course now, and screeners and
screeners that, you know, it was kind of, and the Navy ultimately is like, you know, we're wasting a lot of money and time here with this, you know, so same for aviators.
Yeah.
We now have some programs that see if you enjoy the feeling of G or being in an airplane. And do you have the acuity to figure out, you know, okay, you're looking at a gauge. Tell me how the airplane is oriented, you know, against this gauge.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right? AQT FAR is the name of this standardized aviation aptitude test that they take. So we're able to, through exposure and mentorship and some basic battery of testing, filter out who's going to probably succeed. And I dare say our success rate at flight school is much higher than it was in my day. You know,
nice.
So I think the programmatics are better than ever. And I would salute any high schooler. And it took me an extra year to get into the academy. I had to go to prep school for a year, right?
So I wish I would have. I should have, because my first year away from home was crushing.
Yeah. Well, my year at prep school was crushing down in Texas, in the Marine Military Academy down there. High school run by sadistic retired Marines. No, not
in the 70s.
Great guys. But I went through all the homesickness. I cut my long hair. I had like Bjorn Borg long hair, right? I cut my hair. I'm drilling. I got rid of all the homesickness. So when I got to the academy, I was fully ready to get yelled at and do all the stuff that goes into being a plebe. And that's not the hard part. The hard part is academics.
Yes.
So, I at the time it felt like a drag out of high school, you know, all your classmates. And I went to Havelock High School down in North Carolina outside of Cherry Point, the Marine Corps Air Station at Cherry Point. And, you know, all my classmates are going to UNC and ECU and NC State. And where are you going? Oh, I'm going to another year of high school down in Texas. You know, it felt like anticlimactic.
That's a long year.
That's a long year.
And then fun movies like Animal House pop up while you're a freshman. That had to suck a little bit.
Right.
Too.
Well, that's the other thing. I'm like, maybe I chose poorly here. Although we did make the most of our Naval Academy experience with respect to those kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. So
the drinking age back then was 18 in Maryland. And we had a commandant of midshipmen who said, now drinking shouldn't be a privilege because then you abuse it. So plebes should be allowed to drink. We're like, that's an awesome idea.
Wow.
Right. So we were able to have sort of good times out in town and et cetera. So it wasn't quite like being in the Delta house in Animal House, but at times it rivaled that.
Compared to now, it It was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, compared to now, when I talk to mids now,
it's wound tight.
Yes. So that's good because we lost, you know, a lot of folks along the way. But I enjoyed myself as a mid, and loved my time there and loved my time teaching at the end of my career there. And I love being able to interface with the brigade and the faculty now. I very much cherish it. And this is why we are in Annapolis, and this is why we intend to stay here for a while.
Yeah, same here. So you are doing some work with the Navy Institute Press. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the Naval Institute,
Naval Institute.
A not-for-profit that's been around since 1873, founded by Admiral Worden of Worden Field fame.
Oh, yeah.
That's the drill field is named for Admiral Worden. He was the CEO of the USS Monitor during the Civil War.
Okay.
Remember Monitor and Merrimack, which is actually CSS Virginia, but ironclad. So he was kind of a bleeding edge tech guy in the Civil War. And then the Navy went backwards after the Civil War in terms of funding and resources and approaches. They were like, maybe let's just go back to sailboats. And so his head exploded. So he founded, as he was superintendent of the Naval Academy, he founded the Naval Institute in 1873 to try to solve some of these existential problems. So since that time, the Naval Institute has been involved in basically everything of consequence for the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. And we have a monthly publication called Proceedings, which is a great magazine. It's written by the fleet and edited by our staff. So this is a very must-read periodical. And to your point, the Naval Institute Press is the publishing arm of the Naval Institute.
Right.
They published my debut novel. And now, as a function of the popularity of my YouTube channel, they published the entire first three books, what we call the Punks Trilogy, just reissued those. So that's also my signature novels about an F-14 pilot and life in an F-14 squadron. So I work there part-time. I'm dedicating more and more of my time to the growth of my YouTube channel. But I'm still involved with the Naval Institute in a cool way. And it's a great mission, great team there. And I'm really, really blessed to be able to hang my hat there from time to time. And our headquarters is located very near where your workout facility is, as you know, at Beach Hall up there. And we just built a conference center, the Jack C. Taylor Conference Center, which is an amazing facility.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a cool gig, and I'm living my best life here. It's really great.
Yeah, we had originally crossed paths when you were the editor over at military.com, and I was writing fitness articles for you guys, and that was always fun working for you. And I'm still over at military.com working for those guys, and don't ever plan on leaving until they get tired of me. So,
yeah, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. You're a franchise. Yeah, those that was great. I was another unorthodox post-Navy job. I became friends with the founder, Chris Michael, our good friend, Chris Michael. And he was a fan of Punk's War, my first book. And he's like, hey, why don't you come be my editor? And so we remember the headquarters at that time was in San Francisco. Yeah. I was living in Southern Maryland because I'd just finished, or at the time I was working at the Naval Air Systems Command on the V-22 Osprey program. And I'm like, I'm not moving to San Francisco. And he said, you don't have to move to San Francisco. Just come out here occasionally and work out of a home office. So that was the first idea I had. Oh, you can work out of a home office.
Isn't that awesome? I love it.
Take for granted, right? And so that was a blast. Taught me a lot about the media space and the digital sort of thing. And it's kind of become what I do now. And then the growth of this YouTube channel was another sort of, you know, again, we know about just doing something and see what happens. Right.
Let's talk about that. You know, Ward Carroll is the name of your YouTube channel. That is your name as well. And it's all about aviation, right?
Yes. And that's kind of how it evolved. So about a year ago, maybe a little more now, I started to focus on my YouTube channel, which had to that point been kind of a repository of family B-roll, you know, dog show videos and my nephews eating a chocolate egg at Easter or whatever. Some snippets of my band
It's kind of like Facebook almost.
Yeah, and so I was just like, I don't know where to put this, or I need a link to direct people to. And I became friends with a varsity YouTuber, a musician named Rick Beato, B-A-E-T-O, who at this point has 2.7 million subscribers.
Nice.
And we became kind of kindred spirits because, as you can tell by what's behind me, I'm a frustrated rock and roller. He has interest in some of the things I've done. And so he rolled through Annapolis one time as he was touring the Paul Reed Smith Guitar Factory over on the Eastern Shore or on Kent Island. And we sat down at a local watering hole, which is aviation friendly, called McGarvey's.
Oh, of course.
If you go to McGarvey's, look behind the bar, there's all these helmets that people have given them. And the original owner, a guy named Mike, is a big fan of my books. And I'm a big fan of the fact that he owned McGarvey's. So they have their signature beer called the Aviator, which is a nice lager. So anyway, I invited Rick to come here and sit down. And so we just became fast friends. So Rick's like, why don't you do something with your YouTube channel? I'm like, what would I do? He's like, well, whatever you're doing on Twitter, because I had sort of a big Twitter presence at the time, just do it, except just talking to your phone, right? Hey, everybody, you know, whatever. No post-production, just one take Jake Ward talking into his phone and then post that, right? So he taught me how to make the thumbnails, the cool little, you know, things that'll, when you're scrolling YouTube, those are the little things that show up. Otherwise, it's just a screenshot of the episode, and that gets confusing, you know, over time. So I just started doing that, and nobody cared. I was doing, here's my two cents on the political landscape. Here's what I think writers might do if they're starting to want to be a novelist, you know, based on my experience. Here's how I play guitar. And these are some quickie techniques to maybe make yourself look better than you actually are, which is my trick. And I did one about the West Point cheating scandal, which was based on my experience at the Naval Academy with the honor concept. And then I did one called Secrets of the F-14 and Goose's Death, right? So Goose, as we remember, died in a flat spin. He hit his head on the canopy. So explain how the F-14 behaves in a flat spin aeromechanically wise, and also explain what the bold face, the emergency procedures you have to commit to memory, are. And one step Goose didn't do, which was canopy jettison. And if you jettison the canopy first, you won't hit your head on the canopy like he did, right? So I did this episode. It laid there for 3 months. You know, 40 views. And then in the middle of April, I had 80,000 views in one day. And then suddenly I'm six digits, high six digits. So I call Rick, my mentor. I'm like, what is going on? He said, this is what I told you would happen. The algorithm has recognized you as a subject matter expert through some confluence of keywords and interest and Top Gun, Maverick, what's going to happen with the trailer. And so I'm like, what do I do? He says, well, not delete, but unlist everything that's not about aviation. And he's like, do you have other stories to tell about aviation? I'm like, as a matter of fact, I do, right? And so I just started creating aviation-related content and fashioned the channel more focused. You know, as we say, the audience gets a vote. And now Ward Carroll is primarily a carrier aviation. And to put an even finer point on it, it's about the F-14 and my stories therein. But beyond that, it's about the military and pop culture vis-a-vis the military, you know, rack and stacking the most popular military movies of all times. Some history. I'll do history occasionally, you know, top 10 aces of aces I did recently.
Sweet.
Sometimes I'll do UFOs. I just did a UFO episode. My most recent episode is about the history of Project Blue Book, which was actually a History Channel series a couple years ago. But it's fascinating what that was all about. And it's also fascinating how the Air Force tried to push away from that and then wound up coming back to it most recently with ATIP and some other stuff that they're having to do to accommodate the idea that people are seeing things and they need an official explanation. They need to also stymie the idea that there's an actual threat to our security. And so, you know, sometimes I'll it won't just be like, here's how it is to fly off an aircraft carrier. Sometimes I'll go beyond that. I'm talking today, in fact, with our good friend, Admiral Ted Carter, who was the superintendent of the Naval Academy before the current guy. I've known Ted since we were mids together. He was a year ahead of me. And he was a Tomcat Rio, too, that went on to be a three-star. So we're going to talk about, okay, I got F-14 squadron, but what is it like to take an F-14 squadron to war? How does that differ from doing a routine deployment? And so we're going to talk about that today. So
nice.
I'm going to talk to one of my pilots, Scott Kelly, who went on to be an astronaut, and he spent 340 days aboard the International Space Station. I'm talking to him next week.
Oh, that's neat.
So we call this Amigos of Mooch, AOM, right? Like you and me, Amigos.
Oh, nice.
Mooch, right? And so it turns out that because of my age and time and Renaissance background, I have a pretty robust network, and we can draw on it to tell fun stories and inform, educate my YouTube community. And it's really been amazing. So I started this time last year, I literally had zero subscribers to my channel, and I now have 172,000.
Damn, it's growing.
So it's growing. It's been like the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, right? It's been overwhelming. I have a Patreon page, patreon.com/WardCarroll, for those who want to support the channel. And I do a happy hour every Friday afternoon with my patrons who are everywhere from Germany to New Zealand to England. And we, every week for an hour and a half, we solve all of the world's problems. It's really fun. And I look forward to this community. And these guys talk to each other outside of my interface or moderation as well. So it's really just incredible, the what's symbiotically unfolding here. And not to mention the books being republished. I've committed to my agent that I'm going to write a fourth. I've done five novels, but I'm going to do a fourth in the Punk series. And we're just trying to figure out what is this one about. So I think Punk's going to be a three-star admiral, and he's going to be dealing with China some fashion, you know. So
maybe you have him as a superintendent for a little bit.
Well, no, I think it's going to start with him actually on the wrong end of the interrogation table at a Senate hearing or a congressional hearing. Been implicated in a scandal that's a lot like the Fat Leonard scandal that the Navy has been dealing with, in recent years, that kind of thinned out a few of the year groups. And this is, in fact, why Ted Carter had to do a fifth year as a superintendent, because there was nobody to replace him, because all the other admirals had been implicated in this Fat Leonard scandal. Oof. So I'm calling my scandal Chubby Chuck, the Chubby Chuck scandal. And so he's trying to explain away why he's not guilty of any unethical behavior, right? That's how it opens, because he's been nominated to take over 7th Fleet and put on a third star. And so they're like, except you're an unethical son of a bitch. And he's like, no, I'm not. I was just wrong place, wrong time at worst. So that's how the book opens. And, you know, not to.
That's fun, man. It, good job. Nice.
Well, he gets through that, and then he's there, and, you know, maybe China invades Taiwan. I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet.
Very creative. Very creative.
Yeah. Well, you got to be, right? I mean, this is what's up. And I'm a writer, so I'm, you know, although I hate writing, quite frankly, but it's a fight with myself, kind of like I play golf. You know, I got to do it. And so the success of the channel has, you know, sort of fueled the reissuing of the trilogy, which has led to the idea that people might care about what is Punk doing 20 years later and what, you know, and it's not unlike what's happening with Top Gun Maverick, right? You know, so we're looking for that coming out supposedly in Memorial Day, you know, and that should fuel interest in my channel. I've been in comms with Paramount. Maybe I'll even get a sit down with Tom Cruise when they start doing those things.
Yes. You know, so. There you go. Look at you, man.
Yeah. So we're having fun with it. It's great.
That's awesome. Yeah. Good for you. Good for you. Well, I could definitely learn a few things from you for sure with your YouTube channel. I just post up cool stuff of nice interviews like this, as well as exercise. And maybe I need to like be a little more focused on one particular topic versus podcasts and live Q&As and exercise videos and swim critiques. And it's a little bit everywhere. over there.
Yeah, well, but I mean, the Stu Smith brand is, you were a pioneer, you know, back, we were learning from you when I was at military.com, right? And I remember there was some, I was like, hey, why don't we do more? You're like, well, I'm good, right? With this op tempo, because I have this revenue stream and these things happening, here's how this works.
Yeah.
And this was what, 2007, 2008 timeframe. So you were a Gen 1 digital e-commerce and impact kind of guy, right? So to your point, the world has evolved where things like, what are the best practices associated with YouTube? And again, I was able to skip the learn on my own part, courtesy of Rick Beato.
Yeah, that's smart.
So that's how I went from zero to 170,000 in, let's just call it short order. I mean, it's been 10 months, but that's relatively, it took him 3 to 5 years to get where he is.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, like a lot of things, like nothing, whoa, right? And so what is that tipping point, or what's that, you know, exponential growth piece? What are the elements? And they are thumbnails, keywords, knowing how the algorithm behaves.
True.
Building a constituency and then figuring out, okay, how do I grow this Venn diagram? How do I increase the aperture here? And that's kind of to give some of the special sauce, why I'm doing things like UFO, you know, because if I just sort of didactically do F-14 Tomcat stuff, then I'm a sort of a narrow
a
lane.
Little box. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, not that that's a problem, because I will tell you, as a function of a simulator, the F-14 is alive in the minds of a large audience.
Oh, yeah.
Folks who are seriously into it. And I've done some Discord meetings and other gatherings, Zoom calls with virtual squadrons. And they're asking questions about the specifics of switchology that remind me of 1987, you know, the height of the Cold War, when we were shooting 6 Phoenix missiles at Russian Soviet bombers. You know, that's the world that they're inhabiting on the weekends with their, then they have hardware and software, and it's like VR goggles, and it's intense.
Damn.
You know, you have to actually know how to start the airplane up for real, that kind of stuff. RPMs and temperatures.
Oh, that's cool.
And it is very cool. So my point is the F-14 is alive. And when they find somebody who actually did it for real, I'm like treasure to them.
Nice.
So that's been sort of the first step of the growth of my channel. And I have some, what I call Secrets of the F-14 Tomcat episodes. There was sort of a series I did that were the first to go and be very popular. And then I did an episode about Kara Holtgreen, female aviator who died trying to land on the USS Abraham Lincoln. She lost a motor and mismanaged that emergency procedure. And that was a very high visibility mishap in 1994. So I took the politics out of it and just antiseptically analyzed why the airplane did what it did and what she should have done. And that episode was my first to break 1 million.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, it's got almost 2 million at this point. And so that's where I'm like, oh, my God, this is impact. And I was hearing from all kinds of people, you know, suddenly, you know, I'm a man of the people beyond what I maybe was, courtesy of being on TV when I was at military.com. And that's kind of, at first, I will admit, it was overwhelming. You know, because people are asking for my opinion on things and like saying, you know, I've never talked to my grandpa until we watched one of your episodes and now we're communicating again. Thank you. You know, or my son didn't want to do anything and now he wants to go to the Naval Academy. You know, same impact that you have.
Nice.
So you realize this is amazing. But it's also, there's some responsibility there and you got to get it right. Because if you don't, you're going to hear about it in the comments, which is part of the, you know, it's a fair proposition. Yeah. So all of this has been, you know, intense. And as I said, or when I became a YouTube partner, you're like, okay, this is actually a job. And I convinced the missus that maybe I could work less on my day job. So fortunately, the Naval Institute agreed to that idea. And so there you go. And now I'm totally dedicated to my YouTube channel. That's everything. You know, that's every waking moment. You know what
I like about this, Ward, is that we're two old guys staying relevant in a new world of technology and figuring it out.
That's exactly right. And that's what I learned from Chris Michael at military.com, which is another lesson. And I tell this to my classmates because they couldn't fathom, you know, what, you have a blog, you know, again, this is in 2005. And I don't know. I can't tell you how many times that at like homecoming or a football tailgater in those days, I was asked by some, you know, beta type, you know, dyed in the wool military retiree classmate of mine, like, does that pay you? Like, do you make money doing that? You know, they couldn't fathom, how do you make money? How is that a job, creating content for the web? You know, and so because of Chris, I figured out how do you, and this is pre-social media even.
Yeah, yeah.
Facebook and Twitter weren't things back then. And so it's like, how do you grow a website? How do you, what's blogging, which was just coming online? And we put our arms around the mil blogging community, the military bloggers, and that was really effective. And so to your point, what I've learned is don't be wedded to your conception of what is life about? How do people consume media? How should you feel about anything? Right. I mean, I have my own tastes and they are what they are, but along the way, I've learned that to be unduly wedded to them is limiting.
Oh, absolutely. And
this is what MIDS, we run an internship program at the Naval Institute that I created. And that's, it's just refreshing to have them come in and push over the statues and go, hey, Gramps, this ain't it. You think it's it? This ain't it. You're like, oh, okay. You know, I love that. And so as we know, and you obviously interface with MIDS a lot as well. Once you open yourself up to those kinds of inputs and that sort of data, then you're ready for success in this world of whatever, you know, web 3.0, wherever we are now. But what I know is, and this is what Rick Beato told me, nothing is as powerful as YouTube in terms of impact. And that is true. And YouTube does not play nice with Twitter or Facebook necessarily. It's not like, hey, cross post your episode on Facebook and that'll be your key to success. Nope. Mm-hmm. The key to success is the algorithm, and just let YouTube do your marketing for you. And so again, that's what was explained to me by Rick Beato. And once I got it, and once it was shown to me, I'm like, okay, I think I can do this, you know? But having said all of that, it's like being a golf pro. You know, it's there's no guarantees. There is no job security. I can, you know, throw a stain on my channel and the audience won't buy it, you know? And so I have some episodes that are 300,000 views and I have some that are 15,000 views, you know, back to back. So, you know, it's like, okay, as a golfer, I top 10 finish and then I miss the cut. Right. Our good friend Billy Hurley, you know, I saw him at close range, you know, imagining after he won the tournament in 2016, it's like, oh, he's Tiger Woods Jr. And then 2 years later, he doesn't have his card, you know, and it's like, okay, that's what it is to be a YouTuber. Right. So I'm cool with that. That's what you sign up for. You know, it's like, what have you done for me lately? It's all about the next episode. And, you know, are you populating you posturing yourself for success? And so, you know, my editorial calendar is a blank slate right now, you know? So like, okay, what's next, bro? As soon as you hit publish, it's like, okay, good for you. Yeah. Now what?
Well, now what?
So you gotta be okay with that. You've gotta have this insatiable energy, which I learned at military.com, right? Every day is a new day. Right.
One of the other things too that's unique is that once you open your mind and your eyes and ears to what we were discussing, you know, with just being open and trying to stay relevant, is that you really do get inspired by a whole lot more to give ideas to write about, you know, post about. You can definitely engage that open-mindedness for sure with the right attitude is really what it comes down to, because you have the right attitude with, you know, you are growing into your senior years, but you are still killing it. You're still killing it with, you know, technology that, you know, 12-year-olds are mastering.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. Yeah. So I think being young at heart helps, right? I think I'm terminally, 22 years old, right? I love lieutenants, the idea of being a lieutenant. I think it was my favorite rank.
Easily.
I love mids. I love watching their joy. I love their enthusiasm, you know, and again, it's a gift that I'm able to interface with them in a whole bunch of ways. It's about at bats. It's about staying intellectually hungry. And as soon as I knew I could sustain this channel, because it's one thing to have a single hit, you know, hit wonder. Maybe that was my goose episode, right? It's another thing to be able to have a channel that, you know, now you can look at the wife and go, this is my job now, and have her go, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense, right? That's the acid test for me. And so we're at that point. And it's because, you know, it's not just one and done. It's like, okay, I've had another hit, and here's another one, and here's what the monthly revenue is looking like. And that's a function of content and opening the aperture, like I said. So I knew once I, you know, vectored away from core F-14 expertise, here's this thing I did when I was a Tomcat Rio, because that was my earliest success. You know, it's like, I'm talking to you as a Tomcat Rio, so therefore what I'm saying matters. And then when you start talking about UFOs or Revolt of the Admirals or the top 10 aces of aces, it's kind of about, yeah, I flew airplanes, but not so much. Now you're more of a historian.
Sure.
People have to enjoy listening to you talk, right? They're like, it's funny, I got an email from a guy yesterday that was, I actually read it to my wife when we were driving over to the commissary. You know, we're going over the bridge, and I'm like, you got to hear this. So this guy says, his wife asked him, are you going to watch TV? And he said, no, honey, it's mooch time, meaning he's watching the channel, right? I just thought that was amazing. And he said, and she got it. She understood what I meant, right? So that kind of impact and being sort of a pop culture figure in that way is exactly something among things that I aspire to be.
Nice.
Because right? It's predicated on my Navy career and how I present things, which, as you and I, having known each other a long time in the media space, and what I tell people is, I've been out of the Navy as a media guy as long as I was in the Navy, right? So I'm not an overnight sensation in spite of the growth of my YouTube channel, right? I'm leveraging, I know how to write a headline. I know how to work the back end. I know how to do post-production now of, you know, an episode using iMovie. You know, I'm teaching myself Final Cut Pro, which is harder, orders of magnitude harder than iMovie. But I got to do it because my man, Rick Beato, who gifted me Final Cut Pro as a congratulations for the growth of your YouTube channel. Like, I'm his, like, you know, his
student,
little protege.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I haven't quite taken the time to figure that out, but I need to, because it allows you to do animation and all kinds of other stuff that you can't do in iMovie. But all of these things are part of it. You know, you've got to love this and embrace it. And I guess what scares me more than anything, and I think this is why I stayed in the Navy as long as I did flying fighters, is the idea of a real job sucks. You know, having had nibbled at real jobs from time to time, and I'm also terrible at real jobs. You know, I'm just not, my work ethic is bad when it's like, you know, show up, make the donuts, and I'm not good at that, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Everything I've done since my, you know, getting out of the Navy and taking off the flight suit once and for all, is kind of maybe overcompensating for the fact that I don't want a real job, you know, but that's fine.
Hey man, I've been asked like, when am I going to get a real job? And I said, you know what? Real jobs pay real money. Right.
Yeah.
And so if you can figure out how to monetize what you love doing, there's no need to get a real job.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's what Gary Jobson, you know, Gary Jobson, who's a sailing giant, Annapolis resident, who was one of my sailing coaches at the Naval Academy. He did a doers campaign back in the day. And it was, his quote was what you're saying, which is, if you can make money doing what you love, you don't have a choice. And that's where I am at the moment, you know? And so I don't have a choice. I mean, and in fact, if you came to me and you go, hey, I'm this defense contractor, I'm going to pay you twice what you're making as a YouTuber, I'd say no, you know? I mean, because at my station in life, nibbling at retirement, to your point, I want to be in control of my choices, and I want to have the kind of impact that I'm having now, which is really the culmination of a lifetime of work. And I'm leveraging every bit of that.
Nice.
You know, and so, yeah, that's it doesn't get any better.
No.
You know, I live in my favorite town. I'm married to my best friend. My kids are doing well, you know, on their own. And I have this channel that I get to do what I love and sort of exude that to an audience that keeps growing. And so that's really awesome.
Yeah. Well, congrats on everything. You know, one, you know, thanks for 20 years of service. And beyond that, thanks for hiring me to write fitness articles at military.com.
Well, that was
20 years ago.
That's the definition of a no-brainer.
That was awesome. It's been continue to be awesome. But, you know, congrats on just not letting the grass grow under your feet and just keep it moving. You know, your YouTube channel is called Ward Carroll. I'll put links to everything in the description here, as well as links to where they can buy your Punk's War trilogy. Yeah, man, we'll do this again. That was awesome. Maybe we'll talk internet business next time.
Okay. Well, and I'm going to have you on my channel.
Okay.
Talking SEAL stuff. We need to do that as well.
Oh, that'd be fun. Absolutely.
And then, like we discussed, we're overdue for a face-to-face gathering at City Dock.
Yes.
So let's do that sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we'll make it downtown Annapolis here real soon. So
that's awesome. Look forward to it.
Ward, until then, my friend, congrats again. Thanks for your time on doing this. A little bit different tactical fitness report than I normally do. It's almost like I have another series called the To Through and After series, where I walk people through their who they were before they joined the military, what they do during, and now what they're doing after. So it's almost like a tactical fitness for pilots slash your journey as well. So thank you for kind of doubling up my podcast here. So it's very, very, very grateful for your time.
Well, thank you, Stu. It's been a gift to have an association with you for all these decades. And it's really fun to be able to see you from time to time here in our hometown. So, and I'm proud of what you have done and what you continue to do to influence the next generation of Navy Special Warfare guys, particularly, but just fitness, people who consider lifelong fitness is fundamental to adulthood. And that's no minor thing today. So, you know, thanks.
Well,
for
thank you very much, sir. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it again. And until next time, you guys check out StuSmithFitness.com for books and articles, as well as online coaching, but also check out Amazon.com and Google or search Punk's War for Ward Carroll's book. But you can't not subscribe to the Ward Carroll YouTube channel. I'm telling you, as soon as I found it yesterday, I was like, oh, I'm all over this. Look at you. It is really entertaining. So thank you very much for, you know, putting that information out there, especially for all you young future aviators out there.
Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show. And again, we look forward to seeing you very soon.
So. All right. Let's do it.